The Confederate statue in Rome was added to the cemetery monument in 1909. The Southern Poverty Law Center says that was the first of two times when a large number of Confederate memorials and markers were dedicated. And my next guest says it is important to understand not just what these monuments stand for, but when they were created. Elizabeth Herrin-Triant teaches the history of the Jim Crow era at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
And still with us is Emory University political science professor Andra Gillespie. Been studying Confederate monuments. Good to have you back, Andra.
Thank you.
So, Elizabeth, the first Jim Crow law was passed in 1877, not very long after the Civil War ended. Why did statues begin to go up then and the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, so as you mentioned, there are these two spikes in Confederate monument building. So the first one is, you know, it's not coming right after the Civil War, right? It's not coming in 1865. It's coming later. So beginning around 1900 through World War One is that first big spike. So this is when Jim Crow is hardening in the southern states, when segregation is spreading from, you know, cemeteries are being segregated and institutions for the insane, et cetera, just spreading everywhere. Then the second big spike is during the Civil Rights Movement, so about 1955 to 1965.
So, Andra, take us back to the political moment that justified Jim Crow laws and why they ended up being so varied, similar in many southern states.
Well, I mean, what's starting to happen in the latter part of the 19th century is that with the end of Reconstruction, with the agreement for the federal government to stop overseeing the integration of blacks into southern societies, that gives southern states carte blanche to try to, you know, they can't go back to slavery, but they have to sort of figure out a way to corral black bodies. And so they start to do that with black codes and Jim Crow laws. And they start to do this by rewriting Southern constitutions, state constitutions, to try to figure out ways to get around the 15th Amendment to disenfranchise people. And they do so effectively until the Voting Rights Act gets passed in 1965. And so this is just another sort of part of that. We're going to demonstrate the power, and the federal government isn't going to do anything to protect blacks at this point because they chose not to.
Talk about the federal government. But again, I want to remind listeners that this conversation involves you and we welcome your views. Here's a comment from Mike in Tucker, Georgia. He left this message about the largest Confederate monument in the world, which is at Stone Mountain.
As a Cherokee, I'm very offended. I'm reminded of the Trail of Tears. I'm reminded that that is a Cherokee rock of love. I'm reminded of that swastika that was painted on my door when I was a little child in Doraville. It reminds me of all the nooses hanging from the poplar trees in the Old South. Yes, this is Mike and Tucker, and I've got my chisel, and I'm going to Stone Mountain right now.
So then we get this view from Helen Latson in Douglasville.
I think that no matter how many we take down, until we change our thoughts about the Civil War and racism, that it's all for naught.
So let me bring this back to you, Elizabeth, because Andra mentioned that the relationship with the federal government and that these Jim Crow laws, I guess, were made constitutional. Is that fair to say, by Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896?
Yes. So Plessy versus Ferguson said that the federal law will allow the separation of black and white people. So saying as long as the separate accommodations are equal, that they're legal.
So then how do we get from that, separate and equal, to these Confederate monuments? Why are they related?
Well, they're related because they're giving a signal, right? They're telling what we value. So we still have these federal amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. 15th Amendment was just mentioned, right? The one that says that black men can now vote. So we still have these laws on the books, but the monuments are signaling that in spite of these laws, black people can expect to be second-class citizens, right? So the monuments are saying we value these ideas that the Confederacy stood for, that blacks are not, you know, worthy of being full citizens, that in fact they should be slaves. And so these statues, you know, put that on the landscape.
Andre mentioned earlier that many of these memorials went up in front of courthouses or mm-hmm. near city and town governments. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I mean, one, it's in part, it shows a public-private partnership. So oftentimes, if you look at the statues, it'll note sort of who puts them up. And
I've looked at every single memorial in Georgia, and almost all of them were paid for by the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
Yeah. Right. And so, I mean, and they're really interesting gender things about implicating women in this, because oftentimes the stereotypes about women being the voice of reason and all these kinds of things, and yet they are putting their lot in with the lost cause and sort of creating this kind of counter-narrative and this alternative history about things that happen. But these partnerships are created, oftentimes to great fanfare, to sort of, you know, talk about the sort of the justness of the cause. So in some ways, it's actually very unrepentant. So, you know, this was part of that integration process. It wasn't just about integrating slaves as full citizens into the United States right after the Civil War. There was also a conversation about, well, how do we integrate the South back into the Union? And so here, I would interpret this as Southern communities that were redefining the terms on which they were going to be American citizens again. And one of those terms is, we're not sorry for the Civil War. And we weren't wrong. I mean, because a lot of the language that you see on some of these inscriptions talks about the justness of the cause. So if I could read for a second, this is on the Jefferson Davis Monument in Richmond, Virginia. With constancy and courage unsurpassed, he sustained the heavy burden laid upon him by his people. When their cause was lost with dignity, he met defeat with fortitude. He endured imprisonment and suffering with entire devotion. He kept the faith. So, I mean, this is a guy who ran away, but, you know, we won't get into that part, but...
That's an entirely different story. All right, let me play for you, Elizabeth. If you're just joining us, we're speaking about when the two periods of time when most of these Confederate memorials went up, and we're speaking with Andre Gillespie of Emory University and Elizabeth Herbin Triant of University of Massachusetts Lowell. So here is Serge Lecomte. He's in Smyrna, and he thinks there's a role for Confederate monuments.
There's definitely a value. It's sort of like with the situation, you know, in Germany. You can't totally erase history, and people are already forgetting that the Holocaust existed. People believe that it didn't exist. So you need those statues and memorials around to, you know, since it is a part of history, and prove and show to people that it actually did happen, you know.
So, Elizabeth, if there was these peaks, if we look at when most of these memorials were dedicated and put onto public land, he's talking about the historical value of that. Was there more of a historical remembrance value to them, or did they have a political bent?
They have a political bent, for sure. And I would want to respond to the historical argument by saying, let's put them in a museum, right? If they're a historical artifact, a museum is probably the best spot for them, right? We don't have other historical artifacts sort of in public squares in front of courthouses. I think, as I mentioned before, if the purpose of a monument is to show the public what we value, then, you know, this isn't the spot for something that's just about saying this happened in history, that happened in history.
So, Andre, when these two things went up, many people claim that the purpose of these monuments, the true purpose, was intimidation. Can we make a political argument for that?
Well, I mean, part of the research that I'm doing with my colleagues Michelle Gordon and Nikki Brown right now is to actually interrogate that by looking at the inscriptions. And one of the things, you know, Nikki points out, she's at the University of New Orleans, is that there was a monument in Louisiana, and the inscription is, "This is a monument to white supremacy," right? So, I mean, you can't get more blatant than that. And especially when people are sort of talking about the nobility of the cause a generation after it happened, I mean, that's still, you know, it there's a direct tie to that, to arguments today about how slavery really wasn't the cause of the Civil War, right? And so, I mean, these things actually, you know, have implications for how we understand history, which then have policy implications in terms of what people's preferences are.
All right, that is political science professor Andre Gillespie of Emory University, and we heard from history professor Elizabeth Herbin Triant of University of Massachusetts Lowell. Thanks so much to both of you.